about today is Rav Kolinimus Kalman Shapiro of Piazechna. For a while now, I've been meaning to give a shir about him. Signs went up and came down throughout Zal. There was a lot of scheduling issues. Trying to schedule something in yeshiva and other, it's not the easiest thing. But Baruch Hashem now, between Mishloach Manos packing and everything else that went on in yeshiva, it didn't end up happening. But now, Be'ezras Hashem, we will be able to speak about him. Rav Kolinimus Kalman is a rebbe of a chassidus called Piazechna. He's the first rebbe of it. And he's better known as the rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, as the Yesh Kodesh. He was born in the year 1889. His birthday is the day before Lag BaOmer. And he's born to a chassidic dynasty. His father is Rav Elimelech of Grzhinsk. He's one of the big rebbes of the time. He's an einikol. He's a miyuchas of Rav Elimelech of Lizhensk, the Ma'ariv HaShemesh. And he's named also the College of Samagad. He's named after the Ma'ariv HaShemesh. His father authored two Sfarim. One is called Divrei Elimelech. The other one is called Imrei Elimelech. From a young age, Rav Kolinimus Kalman, people were saying that he's destined for greatness. He was born, Chassidim attributed the fact that he was born in Yesoid Shebahoid, and his bris was on Yesoid Shebahoid, special qualities to him, and that he would become a great leader in Klal Yisrael. We know that his parents were also noyig by him certain chumras. His parents were noyig by him certain chumras, that whenever he nursed, whenever he ate, they washed his hands. And they always had him, and wherever he woke up, they washed Egel Vassar, and he wore a yarmulke even as a baby. So there's a story that when he was 2 years old, there's a story that when he was 2 years old, he was very sick as a child, and his father wrote a letter asking the Triska Magid to daven for him. Triska Magid sent to him a silver dish and said that your son should eat out of this dish, and this dish, even after he got older, he would eat it out of it and he was healed. He would use it on Shabbos and Yontif. His father passes away shortly before his third birthday. Around his third birthday, his father passes away. He had one distinct memory that he would say over a lot as a child. He would say over that he remembered Hashanah Rabbah by Akafis. His father was going around the Bima, and it came to a point that his father was screaming at him. After every Akafis, he would say a Pirush, and he would dive into the Abishir, and his father, and he asked his Tata, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm just like you, I'm calling out to my father." And he said that had a very big effect on him as a child, the way his father looked at davening, the way he looked at the Abishir, it affected him throughout his life. When he grows up, he goes to learn by Rav Yechiel Moshe of Koznitz, whom later becomes his father-in-law. Yechiel Moshe is an Aden by the Karlin, and there he picks up different minhagim and different anhagas of Karlin, which influences his chassidus, which influence the way he runs his rabistiva in Pshischa. Sorry, in Piazechna. His father, he gets married at 16 to the daughter of Yechiel Moshe. And his father-in-law right away recognizes that his son-in-law is destined for greatness. The minig in Koznitz was that the Rebbe would get Hagdamas. We don't say it, but the minig ha'olam is that on Shavuos you say Hagdamas, Milin we say Hagdamas by Kriya, and usually it was given to the Rebbe in Koznitz. And and his father, Yechiel Moshe, gave it to him as a sign of respect that his son-in-law should say Hagdamas. There's a story that one time a chassid came to Rav Yechiel Moshe of Koznitz and asked for a bracha. And he said, "Before I give you a bracha, my son-in-law has to give you a bracha." So they went into the room and they saw Rav Kolinimus Kalman playing with a baby. And his father-in-law said, "It's a maisenar," right? which we assume is a bad term. It's a bad thing to play with kids. But he said, "Pshat, no, what does maisenar mean?" Maisenar means that there's a malach, whose name is Nar, and he rules the world. So this person that plays with children will one day teach the entire world. The ashpaz of Olam Hazeh will come through him. Many years later, this chassid came to him, and he asked Rav Kleiner Miskalman, what did your father-in-law see, the fact that you were playing with kids, what did that show him your greatness? So he told him, he showed him a medrash in Yaakov Shmaini, that there was once a person who was looking for somebody to give his money to, and he saw somebody was playing, he wanted somebody that he can trust, and he saw somebody holding a baby, and he saw that the fact that he is close to children, and they could trust him. So too, my father-in-law saw that I was playing with my son, so he trusted me. So fine. At the age of 20, his father-in-law passes away. The Chassidim said, so he was only by his father-in-law for 4 years. In Kajnitz for 4 years, but the Chassidim of Kajnitz says, in 4 years, what Rav Kleiner Miskalman learned from his Shver, what he looked from his Rebbe, one of the biggest Chassidim don't learn in 40 years. So he was Mekabel, his father-in-law was very influential, and we'll see later on that he named the yeshiva that he made, not after his father, but after his father-in-law. And every year he would go to his kever, even when he was very sick, he would travel to Kajnitz to go to his father-in-law's kever. So after his father-in-law passes away, his brother-in-law takes over the chassidus in Kajnitz. But the Gerer Rebbe encourages Rav Kleiner Miskalman and the Gerer Dayan of Piazachna, encourage him to go and set up his chassidic court in Piazachna. So he goes there, and there he amasses a large following of his father's chassidim, whose father had been of Gorzhinsk, and his father-in-law's chassidim. Everybody gathers together to come to Piazachna. There's a story that there was a big chassid who was learned by other rabbeim. His name was Rav Vava Varker. By the time he came to Piazachna, he was already in his 80s, and Rav Kleiner Miskalman was in his early 20s. And his first Shabbos there, he was doubting if he had made the right decision to be by Rav Kleiner Miskalman. Maybe he should have stayed where he was. He's much older. What's he going to be a mekabel from this young bacher? This is practically a bacher. He's 21, 22. So he got a call that night at the Gabbai that the Rebbe is looking for you. Rav Kleiner Miskalman wants to speak to you. And he goes to Rav Kleiner Miskalman. And Rav Kleiner Miskalman said, I was doing a cheshbon ha-nefesh, meaning I was going through my mind all of my chassidim and your name wasn't there. We have stories about our Rabbeim and other Rabbeim, how they were able to see and connect to the neshamas of their chassidim. So Rav Kleiner Miskalman said, I don't see your neshama in my list. Are you with me or not? He said, when he saw that, the person signed on, and Rav Eva became one of the big chassidim of Piazachna. He always had a special affinity towards children. He would dance with them Friday night by Kavala Shabbos. And in general, on davening, especially on Shabbos, he would surround himself with the kids, and he would daven out loud, and he would teach them to daven, and they would all daven out loud together. He would daven with the kids. And in 1912, meaning he moves to Piazachna in 1909 at the age of 20, four years later, the dayan of Piazachna, the Rebbe of Piazachna, passes away, and the townspeople offer of Kleiner Miskalman to be Rav. He says he doesn't want to. He says because he has a son. The son should become Rav. And it's not right. But the people tell him that we want you. So he worked out a deal that the Rav's son should be the Dayan. And the salary should go to the Rav's son. He's not going to be paid. He's just going to have the title Rav. And he'll give the drashas on Shabbos in the main shul. In 1918, due to World War I, which a lot of Jews did, they moved to the city. He moves to Warsaw. He relocates to Warsaw for the war. And he ends up staying there. He ends up splitting his time between Warsaw and Piazachna. He had from Shabbos Nachamu until Shabbos Bereshit, he was in Piazachna. And the rest of the time he was in Warsaw, occasionally going to Piazachna when the need arose. So in 1923, about 5 years after he gets to Warsaw, he establishes a yeshiva called Das Moshe, which people view as a precursor to Chachmei Lublin. He had a lot of similar policies. The dormitory and everything was taken care of by Gashmias. He was living in Mamash Shack in a tiny apartment, but he made sure the Gashmis Yeshiva was beautiful. He took care of the Bachram. He said the Bachram need to have good Gashmis, and he made it a priority of the Yeshiva that the Bachram should be taken care of. They say that the test to get in was to know 60 daf in Baal Peh. The Yeshiva was very oriented towards Halacha, Yeredeya, Smicha. That was the focus of the yeshiva. He felt it would give the Bachram a geshmak by having coming out with something and learning smicha, and he encouraged Bachram to do it. The yeshiva started off very small, but eventually it grows to have around 350 to 400 Bachram by the outbreak of the war. He was known to have a very personal kasher relationship with all the bachrim. He would regularly invite them to come over to his house for meals, and he would speak to them in learning, in the darkei achsidus, in darkei avoida. And he was very, very close to the bachrim, the bugur bachrim, and the shvachra bachrim. He was mekarev everybody. There's a story that one time, he was also very involved in davening, if someone would be drafted to the army, he would daven for them that they should be released. And at one point, a bacher that came to him, a bacher was in good physical physique, and he came to the Rebbe, he said, Rebbe, they're going to draft me, and there's no way they're letting me out. He was an ox, a big guy. There's no way they're not going to draft me. So he said, Ms. Kalman went to the fireplace, he took, again, I don't know, for some reason the video is not working, but he took ash, and he put it on his forehead, and he wrote something on his forehead, and he said, I want you to go to the draft office right now. Don't talk to anybody. Don't look at anybody until from here to the draft office, and go there. And he goes and he walks in to the Polish draft office. And when they see his face, they tell him to get out. We don't want you in the army. So he goes back to the Rebbe and he asks the Rebbe, "What did you do? What was this whole writing on my forehead?" He said, "It's a Soid Hamalachim." But he was known to do nisim, but he prioritized being Makariv Yidin. He said the biggest miracle is not nisim, open miracles, but rather taking a simple Yid and turning him to Oved Hashem. That is the biggest miracle. He would often say in the name of his father that one who sacrifices himself for another Yid, for another Yiddish neshama, is greater than somebody that goes in Mesiras Nefesh. Why? Because one who gives himself up, he gave a mashal, it's like one that goes, somebody gives up his life for the king's son. And if somebody that gives up their life for the king, who shows a greater love for the king? So he said the person that gives his life up for the king's son is greater than the person that gives his life for the king. Because everybody in the world, everybody in the kingdom loves the king. But to show that even what the king loves is special to you, you're going to go on and risk your life for his son, you give up his life for his son, that shows a greater love to the king. Therefore, he would say to somebody who gives himself up is Meister Nefesh for other Yidden is greater than somebody who goes on Meister Nefesh for the Eivishter. Fine. He said a Rebbe that's not willing to go through Gehenna and back to save and to help one of his Chassidim is not really a real Rebbe. A Rebbe has to be willing to give up everything for Klal Yisrael. There's an interesting story that I just saw the other day that there was a Moroccan Yid, a Moroccan Jew that was very sick. And he had heard about Clemens Kalman. He had a copy of the Sefer. We'll speak about it soon, how he had heard of him. But he sent a telegram to him to daven for him with his mother's name. And there was a big yeshua and the person was healed. So they sent him, this village in Morocco, sent him a ksav and skashrus of about 100 people to tell him that they want to be his chassidim. So he had a mamish all over the world. We know that when Rav Shimon Shkop was in the hospital in Warsaw, Rav Shimon wouldn't do anything without first speaking to Rav Kleinemus Kalman. Without first getting his bracha, he wouldn't do any medical procedures. He had always asked, he sent a message to Rav Shimon asking him for advice, to Rav Kleinemus Kalman asking him what to do. He had a very special desire in Eretz to live, to settle, to buy land in Eretz Yisrael. The problem was he wanted to buy land outside, right outside of Yerushalayim. It was very expensive, and the Chassidim saw how much was bankrupting their Rebbe, and they asked him, "Let us help you. Let us buy the land for you." So he said to buy something on Yenem's geld is nishkein kunz. The kunz is to use your own money to give something up for it. Fine. So before the outbreak of the war, he had written written his sefer called, the sefer is called Chivas HaTalmidim. Chivas HaTalmidim is basically a guide to how to be a 12-year-old. It's basically a guide of how to be a 12-year-old. He's telling the kids, don't be scared off by Yiddishkeit. He realizes the kids are getting turned off by Yiddishkeit. It's very scary. He says, don't be scared. You see those old rabbis, you can still play ball, you can still do all the things the kids do. Yiddishkeit doesn't tell you to give that up. Rather, he tells them the things that people tell them are weaknesses, the chesrodes that they have, they're aggressive, they're nachshonis. It's a midah that you could be a good leader. And he goes through all these midas ra, so to speak, that people told you have bad character traits, and how you can use it out positively. Use it out to the good. And he says, don't tell me it's impossible for you to learn, because you learned how to sleep in your bed without falling off, without anybody ever teaching you. You taught yourself that in your sleep. You taught yourself how to sleep and not falling off the bed without being awake. So for sure, you can train yourself to use it out, your natural disposition towards good. So this Sefer Chavos HaTamidim becomes a staple of Chinuch, and it's really read over. He prints the back three Mamorim, Shlosha Mamorim, where this is much more Kabbalistic. He's over there, he speaks in Yonim and Kabbalah, but he always wanted the two things to be printed together, even when many people asked him not to. He eventually prints another Sefer, which is meant for people, Hacharas HaAvreichem, which is when somebody's 18, then another Sefer was for 25-year-olds. Basically telling them, giving them guidance throughout their lives. And these become very popular. The other two weren't printed and disseminated as why weren't printed until much later. So before the war, he was working on three Sfarim. He was working on a Pirish, on the Zohar. He was working on a collection of his Mamorim, of his Torahs called Derech HaMelech. And the third was a Sefer HaLacha. We all lost him in the war. He had another Sefer, Ksav HaZirus, where he describes... where he describes the need to basically send out shluchim throughout Poland, throughout Europe. He says nowadays people in Poland and Europe aren't experiencing authentic Yiddishkeit. We need people to show them the chayis of Yiddishkeit and the reichkeit of Yiddishkeit and encourage them to do Torah mitzvahs. And he describes the idea of sending out talmidim, chassidim, to set up chassidish communities and fabreng with the people there and to show them the chayis and the beauty of Yiddishkeit. He said that this sefer should only be printed once and should only be given to the chassidim. But after the war, the Gerer Rebbe told the chassidim they have to reprint it. We can't lose anything. And he told them to reprint it, even though the Rebbe said they should only be the first printing. He said because it was a different time. Now after the Milchama, we need everything that we can get. Fine. So now we're gonna get into his time as the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, which is what he's most known for in his sefer, the Eish Kodesh. 2 days after Yom Kippur on Yud Beis Tishrei, Warsaw is bombed. In the bombing, his son is hit by shrapnel, and they have to take him to the hospital. So when he goes to the hospital, his daughter-in-law comes with him, his son's wife, and either it's his daughter or his sister-in-law, depending on which gears of the story. And the hospitals are packed, obviously. And only he is the only one that goes with his son. His daughter-in-law and the other woman stay outside. And as they're in the hospital, a bomb drops outside of the hospital and kills his daughter-in-law and sister-in-law. And his only son, Reb Elimelech, Ben Zion, is gravely injured. And he goes back, he has to go somewhere else. So now, his wife had died before the war. His only son is about to die. His daughter-in-law has just passed away. Either his daughter or sister-in-law passed away, depending on the gears of the story. At the same time, one of his chassidim, the way it worked was, at that time, before the war, they wore all their jewelry. So, one of the bachrim saw that these were the jewels of Kajnitz, they were passed down in the dynasties. So the Bachar wanted to save the jewelry, and the Gestapo arrested him for trying to loot the corpses. So now he has to bury his daughter, he has to find medical care for his son, and he's worried about his chassid. So the next day he goes to the Gestapo offices. Now imagine this, the guy is going to the Gestapo offices to tell him, to try to get this guy away from the Nazis. He goes, and the Nazis tell him to come back tomorrow. And he goes again, and he walked away. He got the guy out, and he was very happy that he was able to save a life. And because of that, his son is sitting at home dying, and his daughter and sister haven't been buried yet. But he set aside time to save this guy to go to the Gestapo offices. Fine. So he finally manages to bury his daughter about Erev Yom Tov. He buries his daughter. Sukkot, public gatherings. The Nazis have outlawed public gatherings. And they get together in Sukkot in a sukkah, in a small sukkah. And he doesn't want one of the younger chassidim to be chazan, because he said they're going to be upset, they're not going to daven with such simcha. He wants one of the older chazanim to daven, who's going to sing all the nuschayas. And they do it, and he davens, and it's a beautiful, they're singing, and it's a regular yomtiv davening with his slavos, and halal is beautiful, until it comes to Kriyas HaTorah, when they say, Kael, when they start saying a special certain tefillah, the chazan starts crying. And Rav Kolinowitz gets up and says, it's yomtiv, we have to be besameach, we have to be happy, and he starts singing and dancing. On the second day of Sukkot, his son passes away. That year, Sukkot was a three-day Yom Tov, so Matzah Sukkot, the first day of Chol HaMoed, is Shabbos. So Shabbos, he acts normally as a regular Tish, the regular everything, and he's fearing, and he's singing, and he's fearing Tish B'Simcha. As soon as Shabbos is over, though, he starts crying, and he sees it, the Rebbe is broken. They bury his son on the second day of Chol HaMoed. So Simchas Torah, Word goes out that the Rebbe is doing hakafas in a secret place, because they don't want the Nazis to find them. Again, like we mentioned, public gatherings have been outlawed, and he's late. And people are saying he finally gave in. He lost everything. His wife's dead. His only son's dead. His daughter-in-law's dead. His daughter's dead by some accounts. There's nothing for him. The Rebbe's not coming. It was a nice idea. It was beautiful. But it's not happening. But he walks in a little late. He walks in, though. We actually have a description from a survivor what these hakafas were like. I had it in front of me. I would read it inside. I don't know. I don't have it in front of me right now. But he walked in. He's dressed like a Rebbe. B'levush Malchus. And he walks in. And he goes up to the Amud, and he says, Baruch Hu, with the Niggin, Baruch Hu. And he goes up, and Hakafas, they say, started, the guy Riot started in a very somber tone. Nobody's going to dance. And in Kajnitz, and like certain Chassidusim, the only person that dances is the Rebbe. So if the Rebbe's not dancing, we're not dancing, so it's very somber, it's very sad. Then he starts Eish Yischayil. Eish Yischayil, in Kajnitz, the Minhag was to sing Eish Yischayil by Hakafas, with a very fast Niggin. Because the Torah and the Eibush and HaKadosh Baruch and the Yidin, so they were singing Eish Yischayil. And they said for hours he was singing Eish Yischayil and dancing and crying and singing. And he went over to Yidin, he grabbed him by the lapel, and he said, there's nothing in the world that I would give up for being a Jew. And he continued to sing Eish Yischayil and dance the whole night. It was the biggest lavas he had. So he becomes the de facto Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto. The leader, he gives guidance to people throughout the time of the ghetto. And this will work. Fine. So he throughout the time of the ghetto, he makes shalashudas. And we actually have the records of how many people were there. There was a person by the name of Emmanuel Rosenblum, Ringo Bloom, I think, for the Ringo Bloom Archives. He was a historian within the ghetto walls, and he made it his job, his mission, to document the goings-on of the ghettos. What happened, how many people were there, and he documented the whole Poland. When they heard what happened in Lodz in the different ghettos, he sent people out to figure out what happened to those Jews. And he sent out spies. There was one of an Israeli member of Knesset, she later became a Knesset of Knesset, and she was one of his spies. And he documents, he writes, by the way, in the ghetto, he said there were, at the height of the ghetto, he took very detailed numbers, there were 13 people for every square meter. Of living space, there was 13 people. Imagine that. It took the Germans a long time to set up the ghetto, because we mentioned last year in our history classes that Jews were really the first people to go settle in cities. To leave the countryside and settle en masse in cities and villages. So all the infrastructure, the hospital, the cathedrals, the municipal buildings, the downtown is in the Jewish quarter, right next to the Jews. So the ghetto is not a box. The Warsaw ghetto is zigzags and there are bridges. So it took the Nazis a while to build the wall. So what it really was the Polish people that would find Jews, they would turn them into the Gestapo. That's what held them in, for at least for the beginning. The Rebbe at this point encouraged everybody they could to leave the ghetto. All the Chassidim that came to him encouraged them to leave the ghetto. And when Chassidim were crying, he said, that's not how two Yidden go away. We speak to them in learning. Before we leave each other, we speak in learning. We say Dvar Torah. We speak in learning. So Emanuel Ringelblum documented that at the time when public gatherings were outlawed, the Pizhechna had about 300 people coming to every Shalashudas, and he writes there in the records that he didn't only have Frumba people, he didn't only have he had secular Jews also, he had people from all walks of life gathering in the ghetto and coming together to hear Torah, to hear Chassidus. And he inspired them. The collection of Sfarim that we have, those collections of Divrei Torah that he had, he gave over to Ringelblum, who buried them. And in 1950, we'll speak about how they were found later, but they were found, and they were printed under the name Esh Kodesh, Holy Fire, which is a musik that he speaks out in the Sefer. Over there, so like we said, so Sukkos, his mother dies Zayin Cheshvan that year also because of the starvation. The calorie, we know the rations. The rations that were giving out in the ghetto were between 150 and 200 calories a day per person. To put that in perspective, the average person eats between 2 and 3,000 calories a day to survive. So that's what we eat normally. So to put that in perspective, so how did the Jews survive? So they had kids. They would dig holes and kids would escape and try to get some money to put together some food for the rest of the people in the ghetto. But people, we have videos, if you have time afterwards, we have Nazi officers went in a break and they took a camera and they went through the ghetto. We have videos of this. It's online. And you see Pasha people dying in the streets. Ringelblum writes, we have the records of the Chevra Kadisha. On an average time, they would at the height of the starvation, the Chevra Kadisha was picking up 300 bodies a day off the streets. People were pasha dying on the streets, and there was nothing you could do for them. So Rav Chaim Miskalman survived and got food because he worked for in a factory. There was a Gerer Chassid that owned a factory. Obviously, the Nazi took it, but what he did was he ran the factory. He used to own it. The Nazis took it away, and now he was only the manager. So he made it his point to employ as many Rebbes and Rabbanim and Talmidei Chachamim as he can, because that guaranteed survival. If you were necessary, so you get better food rations and you weren't killed. So that's how you survived the war. So again, these Torahs that he says over Shalashudas usually have things to do. They put out a beautiful new print where he dates every Torah every week that he says it. If he doesn't say the word Nazi or German or ghetto once, he speaks very much about depressing topics, obviously, about Geula, about God's punishment, about questioning God, but he never directly speaks about things happening to him directly. So if you didn't know when it was written, you would think that it was just a Rebbe with a more of a serious tone. But we know that he dated everything. And there's a new Sefer now where they correspond, where they found not the historical details of what was going on that week in the ghetto that he addressed. He doesn't say it outright, but we know which parts he was addressing in his Dvar Torah by knowing what went on in the ghetto. So the first Torah that we have from him is Parshas Chayisara. Parshas Chayisara, he speaks about how the Zohar says, so the Medrash says that Sarah passed away after she heard what happened to Yitzchak, that he was brought up as a karban. The Sultan told you, your husband killed him and she died. He quotes a Zohar. The Zohar explains that why did he die? Why did Sarah die? Because Sarah was protesting. He said, a God that wants human life, a God that could do that, is not a God that I want to be with, is not a world that I want to be in. And she died, so to speak, in protest. Which is a very bold statement to say. And he said, he quoted Remedel Miriminov. Remedel Miriminov was famous for saying that Sardis, that Daigas, that suffering is compared to salt. Just like when you put a little bit of salt, it brings out a flavor. So too, when you have a little bit of suffering, it develops character. But too much is going to ruin the meat. So he said, Eibishter, too much suffering is going to ruin your people. That's how he started off. So he was very powerful and inspired the people in the ghetto. Like we mentioned, so he gives his writings to Ringo Bloom, to Berry. And in 1950, they're discovered by two Polish construction workers. What happened was that the entire Poland was leveled by the Nazis, because we know that there was an uprising in the Jewish ghetto. After that, though, there was an uprising in the entire city of Poland. And Heinrich Himmler, the Nazi general officer, whatever, said that as punishment, the city of Warsaw should be wiped off the face of the earth, should be wiped off the map. So they try to level and destroy as much of Warsaw as possible. So in the 40s and 50s, a lot of construction. So in 1945, 46, they find the first cache of Ringel Blum's archives, but Reclinimus' writings haven't been found yet. In 1950, they find his ksavim. At first, the Polish people open it, they expect to find gold, and when they find paper, they think of throwing it away. What does Jews' writing have to do with us? But they end up keeping it, and the foreman decides to keep it and gives it to the Jewish Heritage Society of Poland. That's how we have it eventually. So we only have 5 minutes left. We only made this till 6:40, the account. So just to finish off quickly, so Shad, we're missing out a little bit, but just to finish off quickly, so. He is eventually deported to another concentration camp, and he continues his goings on, and he continues being a rebbe in this concentration camp, and he's eventually killed on Dalet Cheshvan. Dalet Mar Cheshvan is his yard site. Some people say Hey Mar Cheshvan. He is killed. The Chassidus afterwards, he had a brother that went to Eretz Yisrael. His brother's name was, they would call him the Rebbe HaChalutz, the settler. So he didn't become a rabbi, he was more of a Zionist, but his son, the Gerer Rebbe, the Imri, encouraged him to reopen Piazechna, and he had Chassidus. Right now, I think his son is now Rebbe Menachem Kalman, and he has a shul in Beit Shemesh. He's about 200-300 people there, and he tries to keep up the minhagim of Piazechna. There, he's whatever they say. You go there, you see his mom. He spends time with the kids. He makes sure every little kids have foods, and that mahalach of his great uncle. Fine.